The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And greetings, everybody. I'm John Loeffler. Our guest today on the program is Dr. Erica Pitch, Doctor of Physical Therapy, talking about exercising as you get older and how to keep yourself in a body condition whereby you avoid a lot of pitfalls. By the way, notably falls and broken bones that result from things such as that. But you know, we've cited here over the years how retirement is actually changing. People are living longer. They're staying in the workforce. They're retiring at a later age or working part-time in retirement. We actually live in an environment where interest rates are at century lows, investments markets are more complicated, and as a result of that, you know, you can't have that sort of secure level of income and percentage of earnings that you may have gotten way back when our parents retired. The traditional retirement environment has indeed changed, and as a result of that, more and more Americans are feeling insecure, the majority of whom don't have a plan. Yet, as we've emphasized here over the years, you do always have options. It's why we always discuss having a plan.
You know, the problem, John, I think, is retirement environment keeps evolving, just like the investment markets that we've seen. You know, just take a look at the events of the last 15 years, two bear markets, not only in stocks, a bear market in commodities, one in real estate. And so the overwhelming majority of affluent people who want to retire in their 60s with plenty of life expectancy left will, in most cases, place a strain on their retirement savings. Now, that's a result of a couple of things. Rising longevity, because we know we're living longer, and healthcare costs keep rising, and especially after the passage of Obamacare. And not only that, we're living in an environment where the returns are much lower. Just take a look at what you get on, I don't care if you're putting your money in the bank, a money market fund, or even the bond market. The other factor that we've also seen impact many individuals is improper diversification. The investment environment has changed, obviously, with quantitative easing in the financial crisis. And there's also something that we're facing. Even those that are retired could run into this more so than the general public, and that is rising inflation, which eats into any retirement budget. And especially affluent individuals tend to live longer than the average individual. They live in nicer neighborhoods, nicer homes. They have better diets generally. Therefore, they run the risk of diminishing assets the longer they live.
Now, you would wonder why, given all of these facts, with longer longevity, rising healthcare costs, and we have inflation, 0% interest rates, that more people haven't given more thought to formulating a plan or being proactive in addressing these issues. I mean, do they just say, well, nothing I can do here, so I just have to coast and trust to chance?
You know, I think there are many impediments that prevent people from addressing these issues. I think bear markets and stocks that we've seen, we saw two of them in the last decade alone. You know, maybe one you go through, but if you go through two of them, unfortunately, John, the normal business cycle is about 5 to 6 years with a recession and a bear market included in that. And then we got into this period, especially with Reaganomics, where the 80s and then the 90s, where basically financial assets went up every year. So there's generally a lot of difficulties in dealing with money issues that a lot of individuals change their behavior and react irrationally to events rather than have a plan to deal with them.
Okay, well, give me an example of this. I mean, between what people do during their working career versus what they do when they retire, in either voluntary or involuntary retirement.
You know, the thing I find most interesting is what affluent people do to protect against risk when they're working. And then they reverse course and expose themselves to risk when they retire and are less capable of dealing with the risk. For example, you take a person that's working today. During their working careers, most affluent people will buy life insurance, for example, to protect them financially against uncertain timing of death, especially starting a family. They may acquire disability insurance to protect themselves financially against the risk of becoming disabled. And the other thing, too, is during their working career, they have the option to stay invested and weigh out a bear market. I mean, John, the standard thing when we got in the industry was called dollar cost averaging. People put money into the market, average their way into the market, which is essentially what you're doing if you have a 401k plan and you contribute to that plan each month. So even during the down years like we had in 2000, 2001, and 2002, if you were putting money in on a regular basis, you were buying more shares with that money every month during the bear market when stocks were going down. And when things turned around in 2002, you made a lot more money. So you could wait out the bear market. And also, you protect against inflation, the tendency of employers to grant, let's say, larger raises with promotions or cost of living. And also, your employer provided health insurance to protect against healthcare costs. Now, here's the thing I find fascinating. After retirement, many people do not protect themselves financially against the uncertain timing of death. For example, maybe buying a life annuity to make sure, let's say, a surviving spouse or bills are paid. They don't protect themselves financially against the risk of disability by buying long-term care insurance, because with longevity, you're more likely to face that in your latter years. And they don't want to wait out the bear market. How many times have we seen people jump out of the market fearing a 10% correction or 20% or crash, only to find themselves they really got a crash? It was called taxes. And they don't protect themselves against inflation. And more importantly, because we're living longer, they're more exposed to, let's say, healthcare cost rising, especially in the latter years. So the net result is many affluent retired individuals are highly exposed to what I call financial related risk that can cause major financial loss or a lifestyle decline. I like to tell the story of an individual I met a number of years ago. And this gentleman was a banker, and this was back in the early part of the last decade, had roughly about $1 million in the year 2000, very successful, president of a regional bank. And, you know, they were thinking maybe 6% returns back then, which, you know, believe it or not, folks, you could get 6% in treasury bills back then. And then we had the bear market. And that was okay because he was invested in a plan. The company was making matching contributions. And so just like most people, dollar cost average during the downturn. So he bought more shares. And by the time the 2007 bear market peak came, he had $2 million before the decline. Unfortunately, unlike, let's say, 2000 and 2002, when he was dollar cost averaging, basically, in 2009, he got out of the market when his account fell to roughly about $1.4 million. And he went into cash and then eventually bonds, and he stopped contributing to the 401k plan. And John, you remember what it was like in 2009. We got QE1. Then the markets went down in the summer of 2010. We got QE2. And then we had a flat year with Fukushima, the Arab Spring, the debt ceiling crisis in 2011. So we had a lot of years of turmoil in this market recovery. So he never got back in. So he didn't contribute to the 401k plan like the previous bear market, which, as we know, the stock market not only got down to 666, but today it's closer to 2100. And so instead of his goal of reaching $3 million, he fell short and was roughly less than what he achieved at, let's say, the market peak in 2007.
You know, this seems to be a common theme, which we see in emails here on the program. And we talked about this last weekend, the subject of, what would you call it, fear trading, people using irrational thought to deal with what their investments are. So what is the answer to dealing with these fears, whether they're real or unreal, rational or irrational, whatever the case may be? You have to manage them somehow.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is getting the client to deal with those fears by addressing the unknown and explaining the consequences of acting or not acting. Because if you don't make a decision, you in effect are making a decision to not do something. So, you know, you need to talk about the pluses of making a decision and also about some of the downside risks. And the mathematics of retirement is simply a matter of balancing retirement assets and retirement cash flow. I like to use the analogy of picture a dam, you know, a large dam, a water reservoir where water is collected. Okay, that's assets. Think of the assets you accumulated in this reservoir during your working career. And then, as we all know, they release water from dams periodically. We'll call that cash flow. This is the money that you're going to need to live on during your retirement years. So you need to look at the amount of assets in the dam and what effects the water release will have over time. In other words, as you begin to draw down those assets or rely on that income, what happens to that reservoir over your lifetime? And this is something that it's really simple. It's a balancing act between maintaining assets and maintaining cash flows throughout retirement.
You know, Jim, it would seem that this whole thing boils down to managing expenses and investment risks. I mean, the banker story you just told, he acted prudently in the first bear market, but then panicked in the second one.
Yeah, I mean, the issue with investments during retirement, which can span, you know, folks, you take a look at a person retired age 65, the number of individuals that have a chance of living into their 90s, but your retirement lifespan could exceed 20, 25 years, if not longer. And you're more likely in those kind of years to run into various phases of a market cycle. We have secular trends like we saw from 1981 to the year 2000, a long bull market in stocks. We saw a secular trend in commodities last decade that began in 98 and ran all the way to 2011. And then we have what is called cyclical trends. Those are shorter trends, usually coinciding with the business cycle. We have seasonal trends. For example, sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day, the volatility period in September and October, and the strong market returns that we get typically towards the end of the year. And of course, we have the random fluctuations on a day-to-day basis, depending on whatever the worry du jour is. The problem is the financial world pays excessive attention to the random noise of the markets to the detriment of the secular trends, which are more important to their influence on, let's say, your assets and the cash flow considerations of a long retirement. So rather than focusing on, let's say, the real relevant factors, so much time is spent on the short term, the day-to-day fluctuations. Will the market correct? Is the market going down? Why did stocks go down today? Why did stocks go up? It doesn't matter in the short term. What you really need to focus on is the longer-term aspects of the markets and their impact on a longer time spent in retirement.
You know, and I know this is something that you address when you do a plan. You know, as we've discussed here, I'm sure numerous times, there is no one perfect investment, which is why you emphasize a diversified portfolio. And let's face it, everybody's situation is different. And so you have to match both the diversification and the person's situation to what you're trying to achieve. And you do emphasize the diversified portfolio. What that does is handle market risk. You don't put all your eggs in one basket, but also different asset classes to handle different budgetary needs, something that is often missed in retirement. Now, what in your opinion of this is most important?
I think the most important factor is diversification because, you know, folks, I don't care who you listen to, who you read, what you read, nobody can predict the future. I mean, just look at this year. You know, they thought the Fed was going to go in June, now it's September, and who knows if they even go in September, maybe it's October or let's say November. And the next important element is really identifying the long-term secular trend. As Jim Cramer of Mad Money often says, there is always a bull market somewhere. And the key is to identify that trend and align your portfolio with that trend longer term. I wrote an article called The Next Big Thing. And I think I wrote that somewhere around 2003. And I took a look at, and this was something I learned from reading Dr. Mark Faber's book, is that investors really need to make very few investment decisions in their lifetime because these long secular trends are long lasting in duration. Think of Japanese stocks in the 80s, technology stock in the 90s, 2000, it was commodities, and 2010, in this decade, it's been bonds and stocks. So when you're diversified, you have elements that can handle all kinds of market. And that's probably the most important thing to you.
Now, you've often given examples of this in the past, Jim, with how stocks and bonds, say, perform in bear markets. And as blue chip stocks are often recommended for retirement portfolios, what this does is address inflation and medical costs. Yet most investors, for some reason, prefer bonds or cash because they're always worried about a stock market crash. They sleep better at night. I actually heard one guy tell me that. I said, well, you know, you're losing money because you're losing it to inflation and just the lack of earning. He says, yeah, I know, but I sleep better at night. And I walked away thinking, now that's really sound thinking there, you know?
You know, I think part of this is a lack of understanding of the difference between, let's say, owning individual stocks and bonds versus, let's say, ETFs or mutual funds. I mean, if I own Coca-Cola, Exxon, or Johnson & Johnson, The value of those stocks may fluctuate on a day-to-day basis, as they do, because that's what happens in the market. Or they could even decline in a stock market correction or a bear market. But the income remains the same. In fact, most blue chip stocks actually raised their dividends during the financial crisis between 2007 and 2009. The stocks I just mentioned, Coca-Cola, Exxon, Johnson & Johnson, raised their dividends in 2007, raised them again in 2008, 2009, and been raising them for a long period since then. So not only did your income from stocks not change, but they went up every year throughout the entire crisis. Same applies to, let's say, if you own individual bonds. The Fed could raise rates or lower rates. Your interest rate is locked in and stays the same. And at maturity, you get your principal back.
Yeah, but most Americans don't own individual stocks and bonds. They typically own mutual funds or exchange-traded funds, which not only fluctuate, but give less assurance of income or dividends remaining the same. However, we do know that over time, the markets have gone up. Let's take, for example, stocks are higher today than despite two bear markets. So how do you create that worry-free environment knowing this, given the fact that investors always are subject to different phases of the market, to various secular trends, cyclical trends, or just day-to-day random fluctuations? And if they watch it, they can really give themselves some good heartburn.
You know, it goes back to the premise of diversification. You put together a diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, annuities, or some exposure to commodities, such as a small exposure to gold. You know, John, I'm not a big proponent of, you know, various asset allocation models, pie charts, etc., or a percentage in an asset class based on your age. Everyone is a little bit different. They have different, let's say, spending needs. They may have things like longevity patterns in the family that could be different than others or even different between two spouses. And, you know, there's other differences. You know, some individuals have pensions outside of Social Security. Assets may vary. So what you really want to do is customize a plan and target your essential expenses with what I call predictable income streams. Examples would be things like Social Security, a pension from a company or the government, annuities, or let's say a laddered bond portfolio, and then target future inflation needs with things like blue chip stocks. So each year you have a rising income stream. That way, no matter what happens to the markets, short term, you don't worry about your income. It's going to stay the same. It's unaffected by what happens in the markets on a day-to-day basis. And over time, it gradually increases to handle those inflationary expenses, especially associated with the rising cost of healthcare.
Okay, so what you're saying here is that despite the vagaries of the market, which, well, they're always going to be there, that's never going to change, diversification still remains the best strategy because, first of all, no one can predict the future. Number two, there's no such thing as a perfect investment. Number three, you can target customization to individual needs, which is what I said earlier, is not just diversification and preparing to handle any market eventuality. There are also needs for each person. And this will remove many of the uncertainties of living longer, of inflation, of bear markets. And, you know, we've demonstrated this point with case studies on the program ongoing here week after week, including, as an example, the worst possible scenario of the financial crisis. Maybe that whole example bears repeating here to refresh people on that.
Well, this is a case study that we often refer to here. It was an example I give in terms of looking at, let's say, a worst case possible scenario for any retirement plan, which, you know, would have to be take a look at January 1st, 2008, because I wanted to take that to cite an example, not take some midterm during the crisis. But let's assume that you retired the end of 2007. So January 1st, you had your plan in order and you had $1 million to invest and you invested that portfolio the beginning of the year. Now, let's say that 50% of your portfolio to meet your income needs and essential needs was invested in bonds. At that time in 2008, you could have got 4% in, let's say, a secure, high quality bonds. And let's say 40% was invested in blue chip stocks. In 2008, the dividend yield on the Dow was approximately where it is today at around 2.25%. And you had 10% in cash. Believe it or not, money market funds and cash were paying about 4% back then. Now, fast forward to the end of the bear market and the crisis, which was March 9th of 2009. By that time, this is what scares many people, is your stock portfolio of blue chip stocks would have been down 30%. So the $400,000 you had invested in stocks, you would have had a $120,000 loss. The bond portfolio was up 10%, so you would have had a $50,000 gain. Now, your cash was constant. About the only thing difference, by the end of the crisis, interest rates on cash went from about 4% to a quarter of a percent. So in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, the net drop in your portfolio was roughly 7%. So on a $1 million portfolio, it was worth roughly about $930,000. Now, your stock dividends went up 7 to 8% in 2007, 2008, and again in 2009. So your income would have gone up throughout the entire crisis. And even though your portfolio of assets might have dropped 7%, that is why diversification works. No one knew January 1st, 2008, the extent of the decline in the stock market or how that financial crisis would evolve. And that's the problem. Nobody can predict the exact future. And that's why diversification proved itself in that kind of market.
All right, to sum up here, and I know this is going to sound like a familiar refrain, we keep thumping it on the program, having a plan is the best way to deal with uncertainty. It's the best way to live a worry-free retirement. And speaking of case studies, which we were just discussing, time to introduce this week's case study. And remember that all of our case studies are based on real-world situations that actually happen, but we change the names of the people to protect their privacy.
The case study this week we call Bill and Diane Bennett. Bill was a marketing executive at a major pharmaceutical company. He was age 64 when he retired. Diane, his wife, was age 58. And one of the reasons for the early retirement was a corporate merger in which early retirement incentive packages were given to a lot of the top execs and employees. Basically, it was a one-year severance pay. The only problem was at age 64, you know, Bill's full retirement age would have been 66. So he wasn't old enough to get full benefits in Social Security, but he had a one-year salary that was paid as an early incentive fee. You see that in a lot of these corporate mergers. They were empty nesters. The kids were out of the college. So basically, they had a large house with a lot of equity in it.
You know, Jim, let me stop you there because this is a theme which maybe at one time wasn't really as common, but it is today because the employment workplace will throw you a curveball that you just didn't expect. Let's face it, the business environment's become more volatile. And, you know, we look at this case here with Bill and Diane Bennett. Now, were they prepared for early retirement? I mean, because it sounds like the merger and early retirement really came on them like a surprise.
I think Bill sort of knew what was going on with the company. I mean, many pharmaceutical companies went through mergers and acquisitions. So he sort of knew it was going on or the company was looking and, you know, the company had a history of merging or making acquisitions. But, you know, still, when it happens, it's always a surprise.
Okay, well, as they went into this, given that it seemed to come upon them rather suddenly, were their finances prepared? What was the status?
You know, the asset levels weren't what they thought they would be. I mean, one third of the asset was in the company's stock. And unfortunately, the stock went nowhere for almost 13 years. And it wasn't until really 2011 that the stock price started to rise. But still, even to this day, it's still below where it was in the year 2000. So roughly about a third of his assets, or almost 500,000, almost 14,000 shares of his 1.5 million assets were in the company's stock. And I guess maybe the good news is the stock paid a good dividend. They'd been raising dividends, so it wasn't like he wasn't getting anything. But, you know, with almost a third of your net worth in one company stock, he had about $700,000 in a 401k program and $150,000 in IRAs between both him and his wife, Diane. They had a home that was worth about $1.3 million, $500,000 mortgage. In the peak of the housing bubble, it was worth probably $1.75 million. So even though the house had come back, it was nowhere near where it was in the peak, let's say in 2007 and 2008. Overall, John, roughly about $2.2 million of assets. Now, Bill's Social Security full benefits would not be reached until age 66, at which time they were $2,400 a month. And basically, Diane took care of the kids, so she didn't work, but she would be eligible for half of Bill's Social Security. The unfortunate thing is they had $100,000 of expenses, and roughly the $1,350,000 was not enough to cover that. Now, they had $800,000 of equity in their home, but, you know, with, let's round it off to $1.4 million at roughly 3 to 3.5%, that would only be roughly about $40,000 to maybe $47,000 at best. And when added with Social Security, it wasn't enough. Now, a good portion of their expenses outside of housing, which was close to $40,000, was travel, which is, that's what you do. When you retire, you have a lot more free time.
Okay, well, given the fact that they really didn't have quite enough assets to deal with the situation, how was it arranged? What was the final outcome?
Well, the $100,000 budget, as I mentioned earlier, about $40,000 was housing expense, which is roughly a little over $2,200 a month in mortgage payments, property taxes, about $13,000, $14,000. So 40% of that budget was housing. And they knew it sooner or later that they had thought about selling their house. They wish they would have sold it at the peak of the market. But, you know, gradually housing prices in Southern California came back. It's still not anywhere near where it was when it was really getting crazy here back in 2006 and 2007, where you could put up your house for a sale and you'd have a bidding war going. So after commission and closing costs, they sold their house and walked away with about $700,000 in cash. They downsized to a smaller home, basically in the 2000 plus range. Interesting, because that used to be the average home size, you know, decades ago, but homes have gotten bigger. But the important thing, by downsizing, there was less money spent on property taxes. We got rid of the mortgage payment. The house was paid for, and it freed up $100,000 for investing. So they had almost $1.5 million to invest. And that made the difference in retirement by not only getting rid of, in this case, essentially cutting major expenses in the budget, in this case, which was housing.
Now, how was that money invested?
Well, the first thing we did is, you know, Bill did not want to keep a significant portion, almost a third of his assets in the company stock, especially after experiencing almost 13 years of the stock going nowhere. The stock had gone up since 2011, so we reduced two-thirds of that. There wasn't much to pay in taxes because there really wasn't much gains. The stock went nowhere and still to this day is selling at less than where it was in the year 2000. And what we did is they wanted assurance on their budget. So 50% of the portfolio was put in a laddered bond portfolio, 5 to 10 years, a little mix of munis in there because of yield. So that was 3.5 to 3.75%. So that was about $750,000. $150,000 was kept in the company stock. That produced $5,000 a year income, $28,000 from the bond portfolio, and the balance of a little over $500,000 was invested in blue chip stocks. And that produced basically about $16,000. So total income from the portfolio was $49,000. Bill's Social Security was $28,000, half of that for Diane, $14,000. So there was $92,000 of income. Here's the important part. By reducing housing expenses, the budget went from $100,000 to $70,000. And between the income from the portfolio, bonds, and the income from Social Security, it covered 100% of their budget expenses, which left an excess of close to $20,000, which became the inflation hedge to take care of not only travel expenses, extra things they wanted to do, and future health care costs. And so here was a move, John, that essentially was downsizing the home, getting rid of a lot of expenses, and putting together a portfolio that would meet between Social Security and the income from bonds, which would be predictable and close to guaranteed, especially the municipals, that met their essential living needs no matter what was going on in the market. So if his company stock didn't go any further in the next 10 years, or let's say the stock market had poorer returns, but he would at least meet their living expenses, essentially from Social Security and the bond portfolio, anything that was given off in terms of dividends from the company stock and the stock portfolio was excess and provided for future living needs.
So once again, a demonstration of how planning does have an effective result even if you have unexpected issues in your life. And I don't know of anyone who is going to pass through life without something unexpected coming their way, called a non-linearity in the everyday. Coming up next, Dr. Erica Pitch, looking at physical therapy and exercises people should be doing as they get older to avoid worse injuries and things which could be commonly avoided. All of that as Lifetime Income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
As we age, our bones become more fragile. You hear about people falling, injuring themselves. What are we to do as we get older? What kind of exercises? What makes us more flexible? Joining us on the program is Dr. Erica Pitch. And Erica, you know, we're becoming more health conscious overall as a society. We know that, for example, exercising, cardio, weightlifting makes us healthier. But are there certain kinds of exercises that are more appropriate as we age?
That's a great question. And first of all, the thing to know about exercise is your body adapts to the specific demands it is given. So meaning cardiovascular exercise is really great for your heart and your circulation and also your lungs. And if you're doing weight-bearing exercises, can be secondarily beneficial for your bones, just as like yoga and Pilates can be good for your flexibility. So in terms of probably the maximum benefit for people as they age, if you have to sort of prioritize, you have, you know, finite amount of time and need to get bang for your minute exercise, probably the first order I would say would be cardiovascular exercise because of the overall systemic effect, not only for your heart, but its effect on brain function and its preventative capacity for a lot of other problems. So I think that would be the best thing to do. But then if you want to do more things, we can get into that.
Let's stay with cardiovascular because there was a very well-known Wall Street investment banker that recently passed away doing cardio exercises. So if you're to do things like, I don't know, if it's jogging, if it's, you know, a stair climber, elliptical, whatever it is, are there certain things you would advise a particular individual get checked out with his doctor before they engage in this kind of exercise?
Absolutely. And a lot of this information I'm sharing is based on the recommendations from the American College of Sports Medicine. So pretty much they're my go-to organization for all things exercise-based and recommendations. Actually, you know, anyone doing a Google search for just American College of Sports Medicine, they put out position statements in conjunction with their organization and also like the American Heart Association on what people should do. And also they even rate the level of evidence for it. Now, the big thing is with exercise, it does increase the probability of an adverse event happening, you know, because you're actually challenging yourself. But the big thing that they recommend is that for people who are previously sedentary, that have no exercise experience whatsoever, and they have either known cardiac risk factors, such as, you know, family history of heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, if you don't know if you have high blood pressure or if you have diabetes, it's always a good idea to check with your primary care provider, your physician, before embarking on a vigorous exercise program. Basic walking, like light to moderate pace, is not as risky, but if you're inspired to go out for a run, you haven't done it in a while, and you don't know what your health status is, you really should get it checked out with your physician.
Now, what about, I know there's a lot of devices that are coming out that track your calories, track your steps, track your heart rate. Wouldn't it be advisable, doctor, like if you are doing some type of cardio exercise, whether it's on a machine, a brisk walk, or even running, to have like a heart monitor so you know if you're overstressing your heart and what your heart rate should be given your age?
That's a start, but there's a lot of things that you can do even without that heart rate monitor. I mean, the heart rate monitor is great data, and you know the normal calculation for exercise heart rate, just without getting, you know, your individual, you know, resting heart rate and doing all these elaborate calculations, you can just take 220, subtract your age, and then the recommended for like vigorous exercise is 60 to 80% of that. If you're just starting out, even as low as like, 50% of your maximum heart rate can have a benefit. But even more so, just if you're going for a walk, the general recommendation is that you should be able to talk, but not think, meaning so that your heart rate's up enough, you're breathing fast enough, where you have to work and you can carry on the conversation comfortably. But if you're working so hard that you have to stop, then you're working too hard. And especially if you have any symptoms with this, if you're having any sort of chest pain or, things that we all worry about, that's a big indicator to stop. But the main thing is that if you can't say a few words, then you really need to slow down.
So at the top of the list of staying in shape is some kind of cardio exercise, because you're exercising your heart, your lungs, your brain. It's good for brain function. Let's talk about what happens as we age. Our muscles begin to atrophy. Sometimes our bones are not as strong. What about things like weightlifting?
Absolutely. Again, the American College of Sports Medicine recommends that for resistance exercise, they should be trained about 2 to 3 days a week. And this is true for young persons and older adults. What they look at for weight training is what they call the one repetition maximum, meaning how much weight you can lift in one repetition. Usually, that's not really, not something you want to go off and do if you haven't been weightlifting in a long time. So usually what we recommend for any kind of resistance, what you want to do is about 8 to 12 repetitions, meaning a resistance that you can complete 8 to 12 quality repetitions of an exercise. That doesn't mean sort of flinging a weight around and using all kinds of creative body mechanics, but maintaining proper form for that 8 to 12 repetitions, and you're getting tired within that number of repetitions. You don't stop because it's 12. You stop because you can't do 13 well because you're too tired. Usually what I recommend to my patients is I'll just say 3 sets of tired. The 3 sets of tired are poor quality, because oftentimes we hear people say, I'm not getting better. I'm doing this exercise and that exercise. How many times do you do them? 10 times. For how long? 3 years now. Your body needs a challenge. So you need to be able to get tired of that 8 to 12 repetitions. And so you choose the resistance based on that fatigue and quality level.
Some of these exercise programs like P91X, can you talk about muscle confusion? What is it? In other words, if I get used to doing, I'm doing a bench press and I'm doing 8 to 10 repetitions per set. It's very comfortable. Your body gets used to that. What about mixing it up or doing a different type of chest exercise in terms of muscle development or keeping toned?
Oh, absolutely. I think the variability of exercise can be helpful for breaking through those plateaus too. And the muscle confusion is sort of a nice term for it, because what you're trying to do is drive adaptation. And anything that's sort of new or different or novel requires not only your muscles are sort of like the business end, but also requires your nervous system to go, oh, wait, this is different. I have to figure out how to deal with this situation differently. So that's why mixing it up can be helpful, is sort of getting your body to move in slightly different ways to throw it off, and then it has to keep adapting.
So we talked about cardio exercise, and you mentioned that you don't have to go out and kill yourself. Even sometimes a light walk could be just as effective. And I would think as we age, pounding the pavement in a hard run could be pretty hard on the muscles as you get older.
Well, that and the joints too. Definitely, that's when for most people, especially if they're not, exercisers, walking is a great place to start. For very few people, actually pretty much none, I recommend running as like the first priority exercise. It's just walking. And especially, as they're saying that even people who are really deconditioned, you don't even have to do like the 30 minutes in one set. You can do, even just like 10 minutes at a time of accumulated exercise for people who are really, deconditioned. But yeah, definitely not pounding the pavement. So other things such as if you just don't like walking or the weather's bad, all the types of machines in the gym, such as, the stationary bike or the recumbent bike, the new step, the elliptical, all those machines are effective in raising heart rate. It's just matching the person's abilities. Some people with pretty significant balance impairments, I wouldn't recommend like getting on a treadmill or, an elliptical might be a little bit challenging for the, mounting and dismounting the machine. So those things have to be individualized. But sort of any kind of exercise that gets your heart rate up, even like dancing is one of my favorites, actually. Any type of thing that makes you breathe a little harder is going to be helpful for that. And pounding is definitely not required. It should not be physically painful, especially not cardio.
We hear more and more about flexibility. You know, it was funny because my grandchildren were over the house, and to see kids when they play and their flexibility, as we get older, that flexibility, we tend to lose some of that. What are things that we could do to keep us flexible so that, you know, you don't run the risk of falling or straining a muscle? Or you hear so often as people age, they fall, they break a hip, their knees give out. What are things about flexibility? And is flexibility just as important as the cardio?
Well, actually, we have two different concepts going here. So for falling and preventing falling, there are many other things that you can do that are way more important than stretching. So flexibility, like if you have a profound lack of flexibility that's affecting your ability to walk normally, then that's going to increase your fall risk. But I'll get into that in a second. So I'll first answer your question about flexibility, and then we'll talk about fall prevention, because that's a very, very important topic. Flexibility is, you know, important for overall fitness, especially when you have, again, like a lack of flexibility. So for someone with really stiff ankles, it makes it harder. Like if you can't bring your toes up or bend your ankle upward, that makes it more difficult to actually clear your feet as you're walking. That's probably the single most risk factor related to strength or flexibility for falling. If you catch your toe, then you're way more likely to fall. So having flexible ankles is really important. For people who are generally stiff, preserving flexibility can be helpful. So just a basic stretching program. It doesn't have to be some elaborate, you know, 90-minute yoga class. It can be just, you know, a few minutes of a couple of basic stretches a day. The specific stretches need to be matched to the person by, you know, a skilled provider such as, you know, a personal trainer or a PT if they're having major issues or like back pain or things associated with that. But definitely flexibility is an important component. But in terms of the grand time allotment to exercise, it usually will take less of a component of it, of the overall time commitment with exercise. But the other part of your question is fall prevention. So this is a huge one. And the main thing that sort of, you know, we know as we age, you know, things just get, you know, there's muscle or sarcopenia, so then, you know, we get generally weaker, but also the reactions don't get as fast. And people always may assume that, oh, falling is a natural part of aging. It's not. So there are many things that actually can be done to address fall risk. If someone has fallen before, it would be worthwhile to, you know, see their physician and figure out if it was something that was avoidable. For example, it's not one of those falls that anyone would have fallen at, a young person would have fallen. It's one of those things where a normal person would have not fallen in that situation. So either they stood up and got dizzy, or they were just, you know, walking, you know, down the street and tripped. That needs to be looked into, and your physician should know about that, even if you had like a near fall, because that's something that can result in a referral to PT, or in most states they're actually, we have direct access to physical therapy. We need to figure out why, whether it's a lack of just spinal strength, if there was a specific strength loss. You know, oftentimes people may get a foot drop from a back injury, so they can't clear their ankle, or it may be a generalized like sensory problem, so they're not processing the sensory information for balance, which is part of like, you know, vision, your vestibular system, and your like somatic sensation, or your joint position sense. Your brain has to integrate all those three. If you're not able to process that information, then your brain doesn't know where you are in space. And sometimes those things can be trained. The other part about it is being able to generate the appropriate motor response to a loss of balance or preserving your balance. So for example, if someone trips, gravity is really fast. Right? You have to get your foot out underneath you really quickly if you're tripped or pushed. And oftentimes, we don't train at the speed of gravity. You know, most of the time when people are learning exercise, they go slowly, which is important to get the accuracy of the exercise down. But you also need to train that righting, that corrective stepping, that speed. And so once, if you're embarking on a program, get the form down. But then it may be helpful to actually train things like light jumping, like quick lunges, not necessarily big, long, deep lunges, but just quick steps and sticking the landing. That's one of my most often prescribed exercises, because when I'm assessing people who have a generalized balance problem, that is often one of the main things that's limiting them, or the main deficits I find, is that ability to catch themselves quickly. There's some research coming out now are actually training that. So getting people on a treadmill in a harness and throwing them off balance on purpose, but they can't fall because they're in harness. I mean, the worst that happens is a wedgie. Those things where you're actually training that righting can be very effective in preventing people from falling. And that's a big part of my program that I work with people a lot on. But if you don't have a PT or harness where you can train at that level, just doing quick movements, whether it's just little quick stepping, you know, little lunges, or even, you know, sometimes those dancing moves, because it has that quickness, or martial arts, that speed can be an essential part of preventing falling. But overall leg strength can also be helpful if there's a deficit with it.
I want to move on to some of the new types of exercise. Well, not new. Yoga has been around for over 1,000 years now. But what about yoga and then, of course, the introduction of Pilates? Because there's various forms of yoga, some for relaxation, some for stretching, some for cardiovascular. And then you also have Pilates, everything from mat work to Cadillac and reformer work. And there's all kinds of new contraptions coming out in the Pilates world.
Right. You've done your homework. And I like that you actually put those two exercise approaches together, because, you know, Joseph Pilates borrowed a lot from yoga and was a dancer. So it makes sense to sort of put those two concepts together. This also goes back to our original concept of specificity. So just like you were saying, there are different styles of yoga that are for relaxation, like restorative yoga, where you may do like supported poses. That's definitely for relaxation. Most other types of yoga, for example, like hatha yoga, Iyengar, all those things, there is a strong flexibility and mindfulness component to all of them, but that ratio depends on the individual instructor. There is also components of balance. So a lot of, you know, people are maybe very familiar with like tree pose is the classic where you're standing on one limb. But a lot of the postures do require a certain level of balance and flexibility to maintain them. And so it can be really helpful for improving your flexibility, improving that static balance, or, you know, being able to maintain single leg standing or maintain a posture. But it may not necessarily be helpful for training that like speed if you were to lose your balance or have a major perturbation. I also, I think I can't emphasize enough the benefits of the mindfulness component as well. Just mindfulness training, whether it's with yoga or a lot of the research has been done on meditation, that can definitely help improve attentional focus. So that's a good adjunct to an exercise program. But again, its benefits are going to be very specific. So if you need to work on flexibility, it's a good adjunct to your program. Just be sure you have the class or the instructor matches your needs. So many people say, oh, well, I can't do yoga because I'm not flexible. You need to do yoga because you're not flexible. People tend to gravitate for things they're good at. So you see all these like Gumby people in yoga. Well, because it's good, they're good, and it's fun. But the person who's really stiff may need that introductory yoga class so that they're doing it correctly. And that can be very helpful for that. Pilates in the same way came out of dance training. We're really working on core stability and control, and then having that core stability as you're moving in all these different directions, sort of like mobility on stability. And so you need to work on it. You need to work on body awareness and posture. Actually, both of the disciplines, yoga and Pilates, are really great for posture. That's where they can be effective. But in terms of cardiovascular exercise, there are probably more efficient and safer ways of doing it.
If you were to design an ideal program, let's say you had a patient that came to you and the doctor said, this patient needs to get into shape to start exercising. They start a moderate exercise program and then they want to stay with that program. If you were to design the ideal workout program, let's say over a 5 or 6 day week, what would that program look like?
Good question. First of all, I'd introduce this in baby steps so they're completely naive to exercise. This is like sort of the new PT mistake, is that we like dump about, you know, 6 exercises on them to do and then none of them get done. So sort of phase one would be getting the cardiovascular exercise. And again, this is going by what the American College of Sports Medicine recommends, but about 5 days a week of moderate exercise. And that's for just starting with 30 minutes. If they're really resistant to exercise, you know, that can be 10 minutes at a time. But, you know, priority one, get your cardio. And I teach this to actually to physical therapists in terms of people with stroke as well and how to manage a stroke patient. People with neurologic problems especially need that cardiovascular exercise. So one, get your cardio. If you're really resistant to it, start with 3 times a week, work up to 5 days a week of 30 minutes. Goal one. Goal two, resistance training 2 to 3 times a week. And you can do it on the same day. You know, so you have your 30 minutes, and then you can do your 30 minutes of resistance training. So what we're looking for is, like, I'm not going to ask anybody to do no more than an hour a day of exercise. Usually I start with a minimum 30 minutes. So if they're doing, like, cardio 3 days a week, then they can do their resistance training on the other 2 days a week. Right, so that's level one. Superimposed with that, so while they're doing their, you know, 8 to 12 repetitions and, you know, working all major muscle groups, so that may be about, like, 8 exercises total, you know, 6 to 8 exercises, depending on how many muscle groups we can get, like, in an exercise. I tend to prioritize functional movements. So, for example, I'm not going to have somebody sitting in a machine at the gym just, like, bending and straightening their leg, you know, unless they're a kicker. I'm going to have them do squats or sit to stand from their chair. And for some people, just standing up and sitting down without their hands can be plenty. That would be the priority, you know, in some general upper extremity exercises, but definitely prioritizing lower extremity over upper just for balance, for posture, more of the upper extremity and core exercise. So that's the resistance exercise component. With those, on the same days that you do the strengthening exercises, you can do some flexibility exercises for where it's needed. So, for example, hamstrings, calves, probably the most priority, some stretches for the lower back and upper back as well can be helpful, and that should not take very long. Now, the other component of that is the balance exercise. Oftentimes, I will superimpose this. So, for example, for a lot of my clients, even just standing up and sitting down, because of the transition of your center of gravity, that can be a balance exercise as well for someone whose balance may be impaired. The neuromuscular exercise, so for example, my quick lunges also counts as a leg strength exercise. So that can be a component done in conjunction with the strengthening. Also things like, you know, just rising up on your toes so your heels come up. If you're doing that floating your hands over a table, now it's an ankle strengthening exercise and a balance exercise at the same time. So in summary, you want to get your cardio minimum 3, better 5 days a week for about 30 minutes. Again, that's sort of moderate intensity, barring unforeseen obstacles. Like this for a generally healthy person that's been sort of cleared of any cardiac history or anything that would prevent them from exercising and be cleared by their physician. So 3 to 5 days of cardio, then that resistance exercise 2 to 3 times a week. With that resistance exercise, you're also going to follow it with a bit of stretching and balance or, you know, neuromuscular exercise. So that can be standing on one foot, doing those squats, doing the lunges. That's also incorporated within the strength training. How's that for an answer?
Well, that's pretty good. You know, what I found is I started out with just basically cardio. Then I added weightlifting. Now what I do is I do weightlifting 3 times a week along with cardio. And of course I have flexibility and I do my stretches. But then on the other 3 days, I do Pilates with a reformer for strength and stretching because I find that it helps in terms of flexibility, that it's making me more flexible.
Right. And that can be very helpful, you know. Mixing it up. So like for one of those days, just like you're doing a yoga class or doing a Tai Chi class. So it doesn't have to be, you know, all neuromuscular exercise and 30, 20 minutes, all strength. But, you know, if you do, you know, your walk one day, you can have the skill day the next day. So something like Tai Chi or dancing, that counts as well. So having sort of variable programs can be really helpful. Now that's a great strategy to have.
I want to ask you a question because this was brought to my attention by a doctor client of mine. There's this new fad in exercising today. I don't know if you call it boot camp. And you're starting to see this in some of the health clubs where they have ropes, they have tires, these poles with balls on them. And I guess you call it cross training. And he said it's been the greatest thing for his business because people are getting injured.
Yeah. So there's a couple components. So there's a whole intervention or exercise program called CrossFit, which is based on sort of Olympic weight training and some other exercise strategies. But the broader concept is called high-intensity interval training. And so with a lot of these programs, with the props and all that kind of stuff, where you're moving stuff around, throwing things around, the goal is to do it at that high-speed, high-intensity. So you're not doing your 60 to 80% of your max heart rate for your cardio. You're getting up into the 90s, and you're like going up there for just like a couple minutes and then resting, and then working really, really hard and then resting. And that can be really helpful, especially for athletic performance. If you want to break through some plateaus, if people want to, you know, for sports performance, you want to get better, faster, and be competitive, that high-intensity interval training can be really effective. When I was training for my black belt, I was doing that as well because we have to spar 3-minute rounds, and you're going all out. You need to train. Again, we're talking about that specificity concept. You need to train at the intensity that you need for your sport activity. And people who are just outside of sports in the general fitness area found that you could actually improve their fitness, you know, improve their overall fitness or even, you know, weight loss in some cases. So that's how the general population got into it. But with that intensity, it comes at a cost. So the higher intensity, the higher risk, especially if people don't have the form perfect before they go high intensity. As you get more tired, you know, it's harder to focus. It's harder to perform things accurately. Your muscles are fatigued. And that's when, you know, that your foot just doesn't land right and you sprain an ankle or you've dropped a weight. There was a recent study that came out of Australia where they looked at emergency room visits associated with exercise. And one of the highest things that they're responsible for injury was like dropping weight. So that's where a lot of the injuries come from, is just doing things wrong and overdoing it too soon.
So let's say I'm an executive and I just retired. I'm age 65. I'm heading into retirement. Probably going into CrossFit starting out would not be a good idea.
That would be a very bad idea. Do not start with CrossFit, please. You know, start with your walking first. Get your form down perfectly. And definitely start with resistance training, especially if you haven't done it in a long time. If you used to do it in college, get a professional to help you. There are a lot of really accomplished personal trainers out there as well. You don't necessarily need to see a physical therapist if you're otherwise healthy and have no issues. There are a lot of certifications for personal trainers. Again, the American College of Sports Medicine. I'm sort of biased towards them. I have presented at one of their conferences on how to work with personal trainers. So, again, that's my sort of bias. I do not get any kickbacks from them, however, but they're just my favorite because they're just good at what they do and what they recommend. The National Association of Strength Training, there's American Council on Exercise, so ACE. These are other certifications through personal trainers. From what I see in the industry, the American College of Sports Medicine is sort of like the gold standard for personal trainers. So if you say have passed that test, you know that they're a competent trainer. There are probably plenty of good trainers out there that have may not taken the test, but you know, at least when they have that ACSM certification, you know what you're getting.
So, doctor, as I look at this, probably the most important thing, if you've been sedentary in your life and you want to start an exercise program, and especially when you're in your retirement years, you're in your 60s, probably the first and most important thing I think you would recommend is you get a complete physical with your doctors. So, you know, you look at your blood levels, your cholesterol levels, the condition of your heart, and look for things before you start a program. But once you find that, what I'm getting here is three things that you need to do. One is your cardiovascular, as you mentioned, 30 yep. minutes, five times a week. And then maybe some resistance training, 30 minutes, three times a week. And each day, incorporate some flexibility. So you can mix this up, but if you start out very simple, just walking, some basic stretches, and maybe just some light weightlifting, you're on the road to better health.
Yeah, and you can mix it up. If you've always been wanting to try that Tai Chi class or, you know, that dance class, do it. You know, get out and play with the grandkids. Do whatever, but just get out and keep moving. And that's the big thing is that, you know, while you're waiting for your doctor visit or whatever, you can still park the car a little bit further away, you know, in the parking lot. You can still, you know, take an easy stroll around the block if you're not having any issues. So that really light activity, you know, if you're not having any issues with that, that's a good place to start. Once you start getting more vigorous, that's when you need your doctor's blessing.
And doctor, is there a particular book or a particular website that our listeners can go to find out more information on the types of exercises, things to do, things not to do? Is there any kind of book out there or a website that deals with these issues?
So, again, I am a big fan of the American College of Sports Medicine, ACSM.org. A is in Apple, B is in Cat, S is in Sam, M is in Medicine.org.
And anything in particular that somebody would want to look there on that site?
Yeah, so if you go to their website, they have these bars along the top with content. The one on the far right, it says public information. If you look at that tab, it will say search by topic or position stands. Position stands is where it has all the information on what people should do and how often they should do it. Also, on that drop-down menu, they have books and multimedia. So there, yeah, so actually the American College of Sports Medicine has. So if you look under books and multimedia, they'll say, you know, consumer. They have Action Plan Health Series, Complete Guide to Fitness and Health, Health and Fitness. So they have a lot in there for both, like, the general public and for fitness professionals. So when you don't want, like, volumes and volumes of information and you're not studying for a personal training exam, you can look under the consumer heading and that will have information in sort of lay public language.
That's great because, you know, just like there are diet books out there, gosh, there's more diet books and different fads of diets. It's the same thing with exercise. You go into the health section of a bookstore and there's all kinds of sort of fads and exercise. But it sounds to me like if you keep it practical, get your cardio in from just basic walking five times a week, 30 minutes, some basic resistance and flexibility, that's a pretty good program.
Yeah, it's a great place to start.
Well, listen, doctor, I want to thank you for joining us on the program, and thanks for sharing part of your day with us and that useful information.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's fun to talk to you.
You know, Jim, it's interesting because I remember when I was in my mid-30s, I
told my wife, I said, you know, I can't not grow older, but I don't have to grow decrepit. And that's when I said, if you let me buy a real high-end road bike, I'll ride it to work every single day, and it'll pay for itself in less than a year. And it did. And that was the way I got my daily workout in, was riding to and from work. It was about 11 miles. And I did it. We were in Colorado at the time. I did it till it was 10 degrees out. You had to wear thermals and a ski mask and everything else like that. I don't feel right if I don't get enough exercise in every week. You just don't feel right.
It's almost a critical part of your day now. You know, one of the nice things about living in Southern California, it's pretty nice 365 days out of the year. You can go outside, go to the beach, whether you want to go for a walk, go for a run. And I find it's just a nice stress reliever, and just it becomes, what is it, John? Is it 21 days if you do something and incorporate it, it becomes habit forming. And I think that's the real key here, is to be consistent and make sure you do it, rather than what we see so often is people become what I call weekend warriors. You know, 5 days during the week, they're working, and then on weekends, they go all out. And that's why you hear things like, you know, individuals have heart attacks or something like that, because all of a sudden they're stressing their body. But you know what? It's amazing what we're learning about diet, what we're learning about exercise, and just simple things like eating healthy and exercising is what keeps us vibrant.
Yeah, and you, as I said, you just don't feel right if you don't do it. And it has to be part of your life, not just something you do. And I know it's hard, because there were times, I remember when I was working for a big company in Denver, I'd have to run over to the YMCA on noon hour and try to get your work. And it's hard on schedules. Let's just face it, it is.
And there's days you have a tough day at work, or there's so much stuff going on, and you think, oh, I'll just skip exercise. It's so easy to do it. But, you know, you feel so much better afterwards. Well, I want to give out the website that Dr. Pitch talked about. It is acsm.org. That's A as in Apple, C as in Charlie, S as in Sam, and M as in Mary. acsm.org. That's the American College of Sports Medicine. There are a lot of good information there about exercise programs, books, and things that you should look at if you're going to begin an exercise program. Well, in the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk. We'll be right back.